listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Death and the Mask by Joe Pompeo. Liz Winchell first encountered King at Wilder's Hollywood Party Pad on the corner of Franklin and Whitley in a 1920s building designed by the same architects responsible for the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. "I remember the day I met her," says Winchell, whose grandfather was the legendary gossip columnist Walter Winchell. "We were playing the Stones, and that's what she and I first started talking about. We both loved the music. She was not a typical punk girl at all. She was very beautiful and put together in a way that we were not. She was on a different level." Winchell and King would go shopping together on Hollywood Boulevard and run around looking to score quaaludes. "I just remember her being really kind to me," says Winchell, now a licensed marriage and family therapist. "And because I was younger, it was like she didn't have to be kind. She didn't have to take me under her wing. In some way, I looked up to her." By the fall of 1977, King had moved into the apartment in West Hollywood, which she shared with an architect named Stephen Moskowitz, whom she'd met through a roommate service. King remained close with Wilder, but she was going out with someone else, a chauffeur named Steve Rockney. On Monday, October 31st, Mullen had booked the Berlin Bratz for a show billed as an anti-disco Halloween. King asked Rockney if he wanted to accompany her, but he said he'd meet up afterward. The Berlin Bratz didn't end up playing, and when King arrived, she found the place more sparsely attended than usual. She stayed for a couple of hours and left the Mask around 10 to call Rockney for a ride back to his place. Wilder couldn't have known it at the time, but he would never see her again. After King's missing persons report was filed on November 12th, Abra King started calling her daughter's friends. Were they with Jane? Had they seen her? Did they have any idea at all where she might be? "That was the minute I knew she was gone," Wilder recalls of his conversation with Abra. "I had a sixth sense." Winchell, who was living with her mother at the time, came home after being away for a couple of nights. Winchell's mother burst out crying and pulled her daughter close. "Were you with Jane today?" she wailed. "Where's Jane?" Winchell listened as her mother called Abra King. "I'll never forget hearing my mom talk to her mom after she told her I was home," Winchell recalled, choking up. "I remember them crying so hard together. I remember her saying what it must be like to be Jane's mom right now. I felt guilty. It could have been me." By the morning of Thursday, November 24th, King's whereabouts ceased to be a mystery. An article in the L.A. Times reported that the Hillside Strangler Task Force, created 2 days earlier, had identified her as the seventh body found since October 15th in a six-mile radius, including Glendale, Highland Park, La Crescenta, Griffith Park, and Elysian Park. When Wilder learned about King's murder on the news, it was too much for him. "I just didn't want to even think about it," he says. "She was so harmless and so sweet." As the number of murders ticked up, investigators developed a theory that there was not one killer, but two, luring victims by posing as police. The suspected duo claimed another two lives in the coming weeks. First, police found the body of 18-year-old college student Lauren Wagner on November 29th in the hills around Mount Washington. She'd been abducted the previous night, just steps from the house where she lived with her parents. Then, on December 14th, after 17-year-old sex worker Kimberly Martin was reported missing by a call girl agency she had joined, her body was found on a hillside within view of Los Angeles City Hall. Prostitutes on Sunset Boulevard and suburban mothers in Southern California, the New York Times reported, are sharing something this Christmas season: fear of a multiple murderer. Firearms sales ticked up. Self-defense classes sold out. Streetwalkers clustered in groups of six or more. The Strangler case makes a grim fact vividly clear, said a young Geraldo Rivera, reporting for ABC News. People can never totally protect themselves from a madman who apparently chooses his victims at random. The sheer number of women who populated the mask helped define it as a scene. For some, Rivera's observation was all too real. A number of them would soon move into an apartment complex up the street called the Canterbury, which was essentially becoming a dormitory for punks. It stood just a few doors from one of the last known residences of Elizabeth Short, better known as the Black Dahlia. These were bold young women who played in bands and published zines and obliterated any notion of punk as a boys' club. But they were nonetheless vulnerable, and King's death brought the Strangler case close to home. I remember how horrifying it was when we found out she'd been murdered, says Pleasant Gaiman, who went on to become an accomplished writer, burlesque performer, and singer of the Screamin' Sirens. We had never known anyone that was murdered. That was something you read in a newspaper. One night, after leaving the Whiskey without a walking companion, Gaiman was apprehended by two cops. Actual cops, thankfully, who searched her leather jacket and demanded to know why she was carrying a switchblade. I just looked at them and I was like, "The Hillside Strangler?" Alice Bagg, also known as Alicia Armendariz, frontwoman of the Bags, got an eerie feeling about an incident relayed to her by a friend earlier that fall. Her friend, nicknamed Pearl Harbor, had been walking near the Whiskey in October when two men claiming to be cops stopped her. They put Pearl in the back of a car and drove around, just abusing her, telling her she's a whore, she's disgusting, threatening her, recalls Armendariz, now a retired teacher who still has an active music career. "To this day, I believe Pearl had an experience with the Hillside Stranglers and that she lived to tell the tale." Pearl died several years ago. Writing about the murders around the 30th anniversary of the first killing, the photographer and former mask-goer Teresa Kuriakis observed, "The Hillside Strangler provided the tense undercurrent during this character-building period of L.A. punk rock. Punk rock girls stood up in defiance about being paranoid and went out anyway, dressed the way they wanted to. Not so much to spit in the face of authority, but to assert themselves and claim responsibility for their actions." King's murder weighed heavily on Mullen. "How would anybody be able to hear anything?" he worried. "A girl screams if somebody was strangling her in one of the many dark corners at the mask." Mullen hired a 350-pound, 6'4" uniformed security guard, nicknamed Tiny, to keep antenna out for sickos and to walk girls to their cars. Detectives interviewed people who knew King from The Mask, where the band F-Word began to perform a song that would become its anthem, "Hillside Strangler." During a meeting in his office at the bottom of the basement stairs, Mullen gave the task force what little information I could. Mullen would soon have a different sort of encounter with the law. He had obtained a police permit for cafe entertainment / shows at The Mask, which was drawing ever bigger crowds as punk's siren call blared across the Los Angeles sprawl. What Mullen didn't possess were occupancy permits. The oversight caught up with him on January 17, 1978, when the Los Angeles Fire Department ordered the Mask to stop operating as a live music venue, at least until Mullen addressed a list of issues such as poor ventilation and a lack of sufficient egress. Owner Brendan Mullen says to bring the theater up to specifications would require expensive changes, including soundproofing and rewiring, the LA Times reported. 1 month later, a few days before a 20-band Save the Mask benefit at the Elks Lodge No. 99 near MacArthur Park, a 10th name was added to the death toll. Police found 20-year-old Silver Lake resident Cindy Hudspeth on February 17th in the trunk of her orange Datsun, which had tumbled 50 feet down an embankment off the Angeles Crest Highway. "We can see she is a strangler victim," an investigator told the press. After that, something unexpected happened. March came and went without another body, then April, then May. As the year drew to a close, police had yet to encounter another murder that fit the profile. Had something spooked the killers? Were they simply biding their time before striking again? The Hillside Strangler Task Force still didn't have any suspects. It was beginning to look as though they might never figure out who was behind the slayings. Then they got a phone call. In January 1979, the police chief of Bellingham, Washington, a waterfront city 21 miles south of the Canadian border, contacted the task force with some crucial information. The bodies of two young women, Karen Mandick and Diane Wilder, had been found in the trunk of Mandick's car, deep ligature marks around their necks. Police already had a suspect in custody. He'd been a security guard at the grocery store where Mandick worked, and he'd offered the women $100 each for a supposed house-sitting job from which they'd never returned. Notably, he'd lived in Los Angeles until the previous year. The suspect's name was Kenneth Bianchi, a handsome and charismatic 27-year-old, originally from Rochester, New York, where he'd been born to a 17-year-old alcoholic sex worker and raised by adoptive working-class Italian Catholics. A variety of behavioral issues were evident from a young age: compulsive lying, incontinence, passive-aggressive personality disorder, and poor academic performance, belied by above-average intelligence. After high school, he'd bounced around between menial jobs while trying unsuccessfully to break into law enforcement. With no career prospects and a history of petty theft, Bianchi had sought a new beginning in the mid-70s in Los Angeles, where he used fake credentials to pose as a psychologist and began relationships with two women. One of them became pregnant with Bianchi's son, but spurned his marriage proposal and moved north to be near her family in Bellingham, which is what brought Bianchi there in 1978. After learning about Bianchi from his counterparts in Washington State, Dudley Varney picked up the phone and called his boss. "We're going to Bellingham," he said. Connections to the L.A. victims became apparent. Bianchi had lived for 6 months in the same Glendale apartment complex as Christina Weckler. He'd also lived at 1950 Tamarind Avenue, the apartment complex to which Kimberly Martin had been dispatched by her call girl agency. Around the corner stood the bus stop where King had waited after her acting class. Members of the task force took Bianchi's fingerprints. Back in L.A., Varney was waiting for an elevator when a colleague bounded up to him with the news that they'd matched the prints to one of their crime scenes. "We got him." As Varney suspected, Bianchi had not been working alone during the killing spree. He confessed he'd committed the crimes with his adoptive older cousin, Angelo Buono, a minor crook with a record of abusive behavior toward women who ran a car upholstery business in Glendale. To nail Buono, prosecutors offered Bianchi life with the possibility of parole, no death penalty. he agreed to testify against his cousin, who maintained he was innocent and that Bianchi was a pathological liar. Evidence gathered by detectives suggested otherwise. They found fibers on two victims that matched those in Buono's home. Interrogations of Bianchi unspooled the stories of 10 young women in and around L.A. who'd shared the misfortune of encountering a pair of twisted men between October 1977 and February 1978. It turned out there'd almost been 11. Posing as undercover vice cops, Bianchi and Buono had stopped Catherine Lorre one evening near the former Max Factor building just off Hollywood Boulevard. Bianchi aborted the plan after rifling through his intended target's wallet and realizing she was the daughter of the late actor Peter Lorre, who himself played a serial killer in Fritz Lang's M. "I had two photographs depicting my father and myself together," Lorre later testified, recalling that one of her would-be captors had remarked, "Hey, this really is Peter Lorre's kid." Buono wasn't wrong in depicting his cousin as a liar who couldn't be trusted. Bianchi had led a double life, after all. He'd even conjured supposed alternate personalities during his psychiatric evaluations. It's impossible to know how honestly Bianchi described each victim's abduction, rape, and murder. He would later claim to have invented details under pressure from interrogators, but his accounts are the closest we have to the truth about how these young women came to lose their lives. In King's case, the story Bianchi initially told goes like this. He and Buono were joyriding in Bianchi's 1972 Cadillac when they saw King, solitary and stunning in her shiny silver heels, at the bus stop on Franklin Avenue. They pulled into the parking lot of the Mayfair supermarket. Bianchi exited the car, walked over to the bus stop, and struck up a conversation. He and King were chatting when Bianchi feigned surprise at spotting his cousin, as if he just happened to be driving by. He waved at the car as Buono slowed down with a friendly honk and pressed on the brakes. Did King need a lift home? It was no trouble at all, they said. For reassurance, Bianchi flashed a fake badge and told her they were members of the L.A. Police Reserve. He opened the front passenger side door, and against her better judgment, King stepped in. The Cadillac cruised west on Franklin, past the Scientology Center, past Wilder's apartment, before pulling into a Hughes Market on the corner of Highland. King waited in the car while Bianchi and Buono went inside to buy cigarettes. When they returned, Bianchi told King that Buono was in a hurry to get home. Would she mind if they dropped him off first, and then Bianchi could take Buono's car and drive King back to her place? Not at all, King replied. They drove up Highland Avenue, and then Barham Boulevard, and east onto Forest Lawn Drive, before catching the freeway. King looked straight ahead as the Cadillac came to a stop in the driveway of Buono's yellow bungalow in Glendale. Everything happened so fast. Bianchi and Buono grabbed King's arms. She struggled to break free. They slapped handcuffs on her wrist and forced her into the house. The scene that unfolded from there is too graphic for these pages, but it ended with twine around King's neck and the life leaving her body. As King's roommate had said, she was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Buono's murder trial, the longest in American history, began in November 1981. 2 years later, on October 31st, 1983, the bailiff announced that the jury had reached its first of 10 verdicts. Roger Boren, the lead prosecutor in the case, felt his heart pounding as he awaited the jury's decision. He breathed a sigh of relief upon hearing the crucial word guilty. It was like heaven opening up when that first verdict came in, Boren recalls. In the coming days, Buono was convicted of all but one of the killings. "We, the jury," the foreman declared on November 10th, "find the defendant, Angelo Buono, guilty of the murder of Jane King." A reporter informed Abra King of the outcome. "I got to the point where I didn't care," she said through tears. "The thing you care about is losing your daughter." On November 18th, Buono, aged 49, was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. According to a reporter in the courtroom, he stared straight ahead and swallowed hard, but took the verdict with no other show of emotion. Bianchi is serving out his life sentence at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. He was denied parole in 2010 and will be eligible to apply again in 2025 at the age of 74. Buono died of natural causes in 2002 at the age of 67, alone in his cell at California State Prison at Calipatria. The following year, fronting a new lineup of the Skulls, Billy Bones recorded a song in memory of his former acquaintance. "Jane hitched a ride on the Hollywood Stars one night, up to the hillside. That's where they took her life. Glad he now lies in his own deathbed. Yeah, yeah, the hillside strangler's dead." After his run-in with the fire department in January 1978, Mullen found creative ways to circumvent the show stoppage at the Mask, like acquiring a film permit for a TV crew to tape a performance, or hosting quasi-legal word-of-mouth parties where bands would just happen to play. At one such shindig in May 1978, the Go-Go's made their world debut, opening for the Weirdos and the Germs. "Everybody in the scene was at that show," recalls Carlisle. "We played a song called Overrun twice, and we played a song called Robert Hilburn. He was the music critic at the LA Times. That was our set list." With the scene rallying around him, Mullen tried to raise money to bring the Mask up to code. But the modest funds he amassed from benefit shows got eaten up by legal costs, and discussions with potential investors didn't pan out. For a brief stretch, Mullen operated a space on Santa Monica Boulevard called the Other Mask, which overlapped with his stealth gigs at the original Mask. The final nail in the coffin came on July 13, 1979. That night, Rick Wilder had put together a party with several bands, including Wilder's new act, the Mau Maus, a pre-Henry Rollins Black Flag, and a group called the Black Arts, members of which would go on to perform under the same name as the backing band for Joan Jett, herself a scene fixture. Not long before the Mau Maus were set to take the stage, a fire marshal entered the basement with members of the LAPD. This time, 2 years after first opening its doors, Mullen accepted the venue's fate. The Mask may have come to an end, but as Mullen later put it, the new indigenous punk spirit was already too rooted, too strong to just go away. L.A. punk had snowballed into a force that Tin Mask couldn't contain. Bands could now sell out traditional venues like the Whiskey. The scene was spreading to new stomping grounds, places like the Hong Kong Cafe in Chinatown, Club 88 on Pico Boulevard, and the Fleetwood in Redondo Beach. For some bands, the road ahead was paved with record deals, world tours, and MTV. By 1980, as the LA Times suggested, punk had turned Los Angeles into arguably the most exciting live music center in America. Mullen went on to enjoy a fruitful career as a show promoter, music journalist, and author. His works include 2001's We Got the Neutron Bomb, an oral history of L.A. punk, co-authored with Mark Spitz, and Live at the Mask, Nightmare in Punk Alley, a 2007 coffee table book. In 2009, Mullen was working on a book with the Red Hot Chili Peppers when he died from a stroke, suffered the day after celebrating his 60th birthday with his longtime partner, writer and researcher Kateri Butler. In a New York Times obituary that heralded Mullen as a pillar of Los Angeles punk, Ben Cesario wrote, "Although the Los Angeles punk scene has generally been less celebrated than those of London or New York, it was extensive, with the Mask as their incubator, The city's bands began to develop a distinct style that reflected the disaffection of young people in a sprawling, glittery megalopolis. In November, I made a pilgrimage to the Mask, which is now used for storage and video shoots by World of Wonder Productions, the company behind RuPaul's Drag Race, headquartered in the building above. WOW co-founder Randy Barbato, who knew Mullen coincidentally, took me down to the legendary basement to have a look around. I brought along three esteemed tour guides from the Mask heyday, Pleasant Gaiman, K.K. Barrett, and Trudy Argelis Barrett, famously christened L.A.'s most popular punk in a 1978 issue of New York Rocker. As we pored over ancient graffiti that still decorates the walls, Barrett pointed to a name scrawled on a yellow beam in thick black marker, Rick Wilder. He never became as well known as some of the other Mask alumni, but he's an underground legend nonetheless. Fans of The Weeknd will recognize Wilder as the haunting figure who appears in three of the Grammy-winning pop star's music videos. In a cruel and eerie twist, King was not Wilder's only former girlfriend to fall prey to a serial killer. In the early 90s, while living in Manhattan at the storied Whitby Apartments on West 45th Street, Wilder dated a young woman named Tiffany Bresciani. Like King, Bresciani was an aspiring actor who'd found her way into the punk scene. Her relationship with Wilder deteriorated, and Bresciani spiraled into heroin addiction and prostitution, a path that ended in 1993 when she became the 17th and final victim of Joel Rifkin. "She didn't deserve any of that," Wilder laments. Wilder told me King was his first love. I thought of her when I was down in the Mask, where King had watched Wilder perform 46 years earlier. You might say King's story echoes that of the Black Dahlia, two striking young women trying to make it in Hollywood, who ended up brutally murdered by elusive killers, their bodies left nude and desecrated for strangers to find. The difference is that Elizabeth Short became famous in death, while King was essentially forgotten to time. At the Mask, King inhabited the same social space as people who would become stars. Some in the most conventional sense of the word, others in their capacity as subcultural icons. Whether King herself actually had a chance of making it is beside the point. The killers took more than her life, they took her dreams. Right before our visit to the Mask, Gaiman and I strolled past the old Chateau Elysee and stood for a few minutes at the bus stop where King disappeared. Gaiman, whose apartment is a short walk from there, mused thoughtfully about the paradox of Hollywood. It's a sparkly wonderland of ambition, bright and sunny and beautiful, but its sinister underbelly is always just a tragedy away. King may not have attained the fame she sought in life, but in death she became a part of this haunted legacy. Standing beside the bus stop, Gaiman turned to me and said, "There's something about Hollywood that people who aren't from Los Angeles don't understand. The energy here is so hopeful, but also so doomed."
Thank you.
grow and behold at a dazzling Maldives resort. Plant-based haute cuisine puts a spin on surf and turf by Katie Nichol. Opening illustration of the complex by Yukiko Noritake. There's something about arriving in style, skimming along turquoise waters toward resort Jililang Confushi aboard a golf craft touring 36. While sipping a lemongrass and champagne cocktail, one could be forgiven for imagining oneself a White Lotus guest. Located 20 minutes by boat from the Maldives Malevelana International Airport, Jili gleams with white sand beaches, idyllic lagoons, and 45 villas made from sustainably sourced teak, palm wood, and bamboo. Ours has an open-air bedroom, a water garden where manta rays and baby sharks glide around, and a bathroom stocked with locally made organic toiletries scented in rosemary and peppermint. The Maldives has banned single-use plastic. Seven standalone Crusoe villas are lacking in shipwrecked sailors, but come with their own boats. The most opulent lodging, simply called the Private Reserve, sleeps eight and costs $8,300 per night for your own gym, theater, spa, and water slide into the Indian Ocean. Executive chef Harinath Govindaraj, who oversees Jili's three restaurants, recently introduced a chef's table vegan experience, joining the ranks of such plant-based fine dining establishments as London's Gautier Soho and New York's 11 Madison Park. Doubling down on plant-to-plant fare is a logical addition for a resort known for its commitment to eco-conscious luxury. The garden is not just a part of the kitchen, but the heart of the kitchen, Govindaraj told Vanity Fair. My own family enjoyed a six-course meal made entirely of fruits and vegetables grown on the grounds of Jililang Confushi. Signature dishes include beetroot carpaccio, sautéed vegan scallops, radishes, on a bed of wild mushroom risotto, and an ambrosial avocado soup. Composed of 26 atolls stretching across 500 miles of ocean, the Maldives also houses one of the world's most vibrant reefs. At Jili's Coral Line project, 160 rows of coral have been cultivated since Vytautas Kersis established it in 2014. The island's resorts range from the Cheval Blanc Rondelli, where the Prince and Princess of Wales have vacationed, to the Conrad Maldives Rangali Island, where Paris Hilton honeymooned in 2022. The Conrad of name happens to be her great-grandfather. But the beaches aren't just for couples. Some locations, like the larger Sonevejani, which our family of four also visited, are particularly kid-friendly. The swim-up bar at its children's center, The Den, serves ice cream. A zip line provides hours of entertainment, and the Director's Cut restaurant offers silent movie nights where headphone-clad kids watch Disney classics projected on a big screen lofted over the ocean. Back at Jililang Confushi, the concierge staff, dubbed Fridays, another Crusoe callback, can arrange fun for the whole family, from massages at the Mira Spa and sunrise yoga to surf lessons and private fishing trips with sushi making on board. The Overwater Bar, renovated late last year, offers panoramic sunsets and viewing platforms underfoot. Castaways be warned, the triggerfish are territorial. The no-bake chocolate avocado cake, addictive, and reality hits hard when it's time to go home. Thank you. hero of our time. In life, Alexei Navalny was warm, real, and human, the opposite of what and who he stood against, by Miriam Elder. I'm not ready for my son to become a martyr. Alexei Navalny's mother said these words in 2011, at the start of his journey to prominence as Russia's most active opposition politician. 13 years later, as news of her son's death in a remote Russian penal colony inside the Arctic Circle spread across the world, she said that she didn't want to hear any condolences. I saw my son in prison on the 12th when we went to visit him. He was alive, healthy, and cheerful. Navalny's team filled the void of his absence with similar calls. We have no reason to believe state propaganda. They have lied, are lying, and will continue to lie, wrote Leonid Volkov, a longtime associate of Navalny's. Don't rush to bury Navalny. Don't rush to bury Alexei. Who could blame them? Everyone knew the stakes. Navalny had risen from anti-corruption activist to online superstar to grassroots organizer to Russia's most famous political prisoner. He had endured countless physical attacks along the way, including one in which the nerve agent Novichok nearly killed him. Navalny himself had addressed the possibility of his death in the Oscar-winning documentary that carried his name. Don't give up. You cannot give up, he says, straight to the camera, in the film directed by Daniel Rohrer. If it happens, if they decide to kill me, it means we are incredibly strong. We need to use that power. That begins by depriving the Russian state of the authority of defining his death. Navalny was a singular figure in Russia, though he would bristle at that description. He wanted to inspire through his example and empower average people to throw off the yoke of Vladimir Putin's tyrannical leadership, itself an inheritance from centuries of Russian imperial rule. If Navalny, the son of a couple who owns a basket-weaving factory on the outskirts of Moscow, who studied law at a second-tier university, could come deeply in touch with his power as a citizen, couldn't anyone? When Navalny emerged in 2011 to become a leader of the massive street protest that swept Russia, after Putin announced he was returning to the presidency following a brief stint as prime minister, his chants embodied that idea. "We exist," he would yell to a crowd of tens of thousands. At one such protest, late in 2011, he sounded like a being from another planet, far from a Russia that had consolidated itself around one man. "The only source of power is the people of the Russian Federation," Navalny told the crowd. The roar in response was deafening. Now he is gone, killed. Perhaps in the moment, but certainly over the past few years of his imprisonment by a regime that could not tolerate him. Putin tried and failed to murder Navalny quickly and secretly with poison, and now he has murdered him slowly and publicly in prison, wrote the exiled Russian opposition figure Garry Kasparov, and he could not be more right. Navalny grew an enormous following inside Russia by conducting thorough and easily digestible investigations into the corruption of the country's top elite, including Putin. He exposed shady deals, gaudy palaces, nepotistic excesses, and luxury yachts. After he was poisoned on a trip to Siberia, he, along with the journalist Christo Grozev, called one of his own poisoners, an FSB agent, and got him to admit what he had done. His career in politics began on the street and then quickly shifted into something more. In 2013, he ran for mayor of Moscow and came in second. 3 years later, he tried to run for president, but was barred. He founded an organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, which opened regional chapters across the country before being declared extremist in 2021. It now operates in exile. He launched a campaign to get Russians to engage in smart voting, casting their ballots for anyone but Putin's cronies in the United Russia Party. He was driven by one goal, to get Putin and his henchmen out of power. He made some serious mistakes along the way, including early engagement with nationalist anti-migrant politics and initial acceptance of Putin's seizure of Crimea from Ukraine, which he later renounced. Through it all, he remained unmistakably himself. Navalny was deeply serious about his work, but also quick to make a joke or flash a smile. This might not seem notable, but in Russia it was revolutionary. Russia's Soviet legacy did so much to degrade the country, including its language and the way people not well acquainted interacted with one another. Listening to a politician or newscaster talk is often an exercise in acronyms, the passive voice, and language so technical it's as though they're talking about the intricacies of factory parts. Interpersonal exchanges are governed by suspicion or fear. And here was Navalny, comfortable in his skin, quick to call out the absurdity of any given situation. In the final video, taken before his death, he appears gaunt, but still smiling, wisecracking with the judge, who smiles back. His life had become an endless series of court appearances and stints in solitary confinement, nearly 30. The Kremlin's legal onslaught against him began in 2013 with a politically motivated embezzlement case. It continued to grow, and after he returned to Russia, following treatment in Germany for his near-fatal poisoning, he was arrested almost immediately. He was sentenced last year to 19 years in prison. In the photo, Alexei Navalny and his wife Yulia Navalnaya walk in a Moscow rally in 2019 to protest the assassination of Boris Nemtsov on the fourth anniversary of his death. There are so many questions to ask now. What does Navalny's death mean for Russia's embattled opposition, with so many in exile, and others like the writer Vladimir Kara-Murza and activist Ilya Yashin serving prison terms of their own? What does it mean for the war in Ukraine? Navalny is but one man, and thousands of Ukrainians have been killed in Putin's ruthless invasion. What does it mean for U.S. policy, as Republicans in Congress contort themselves into a neo-isolationist force staffed with nihilists whose one concern is keeping their leader, Donald Trump, off their backs? There will be time to ask those questions, but for now, a man is dead. As news of Navalny's death spread through Russian circles, I was struck by one thing. Far from Twitter and the posturing that platform encourages, people were filled with an almost unspeakable grief for Navalny's family. His wife, Yulia, his parents, his children, Daria and Zahar. I'm scared to even think what's happening with Yulia and the kids, with his relatives, the TV presenter Tanya Lazareva said, choking back tears on TV Rain, an independent channel that was forced into exile following Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago. Yulia Navalnaya had reluctantly taken up the mantle of her husband's work following his imprisonment. In the hours following the Russian prison service's announcement of her husband's death, she addressed the Munich Security Conference in Germany and vowed that Putin would be brought to justice. Putin has not addressed the conference in years, and he certainly never brought his wife, whom he divorced more than a decade ago. Since then, Putin has become the harshest version of himself, alone, paranoid, acting on his delusions of grandeur, and in doing so spreading suffering around the world, most horrifically in Ukraine. In that way, Navalny was his polar opposite, warm, real, and ultimately human. We dreamed he would be president of Russia, Mikhail Zigar, an exiled journalist and author, wrote on Instagram. For so long he was our future. Now we no longer have this future. there will be another one. And Alexei will always be with us. He will become more than a president. He will be the Messiah of a future Russia. Out of sight. Inside Apple Park, CEO Tim Cook talks exclusively to Vanity Fair about the genesis of a mind-blowing new device that will shape his legacy and perhaps how we see the world. By Nick Bilton, with opening photograph by Norman Jean Roy, Moonshot. Tim Cook wearing the Apple Vision Pro in his Cupertino, California office in January. The first time Tim Cook experienced the Apple Vision Pro, it wasn't called the Apple Vision Pro. It was 8 years ago, maybe six, seven, or even eight, before the company built Apple Park, where we're sitting right now, at a bleached oak table in this incredible circular edifice clad in miles of curved glass. It's been raining, and the clouds are clearing over the pine trees, and the rows of citrus and maple trees, and the sun is reflecting off the pond in the meadow, and it's kind of mesmerizing. And Cook's telling me about that time all those years ago and his dulcet Robertsdale, Alabama accent when he first saw it. It was at Mariani 1, a nondescript low-rise building on the edge of the old Infinite Loop campus with blacked-out windows. This place is so secret. It's known as one of Apple's Black Ops facilities. Nearly all of the thousands of employees who work at Apple have never set foot inside one. There are multiple layers of doors that lock behind and in front of you. But Cook is the CEO and can go anywhere. So he strolls past restricted rooms where foldable iPhones and MacBooks with retractable keyboards and transparent televisions were dreamed up. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.